This is The Traverse Cityist, a podcast about the people that create the culture in and around Traverse City, Michigan. I'm Gretchen Carr, creator, producer, and host. This episode of The Traverse Cityist is sponsored by the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians Tribal Council. What do you remember learning in your first United States or Michigan history classes? My guest for this episode is Matthew Fletcher, professor of law at the University of Michigan. He teaches and writes in the areas of federal Indian law, American Indian tribal law, Anishinaabe legal and political philosophy, constitutional law, federal courts, and legal ethics. He also sits as the Chief Justice of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians, the Porch Band of Creek Indians, and the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. Matthew is also the author of The Eagle Returns, the legal history of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. The book serves as a valuable reference for people who want to learn how federal Indian law and policy drove an Anishinaabe community to the brink of legal extinction, how non-Indian economic and political interests conspired to eradicate the community's self-sufficiency, and how Indian people fought to preserve their culture, laws, traditions, governance, and language.
Matthew, thanks for talking with the Traverse Cityist. As I read your book, I kept recalling about how my early understanding of local and American history included field trips to the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. In the classroom, I learned about the Three Fires. I kept wondering where the Indians went, and I realized they were right with me in the classroom. I went to school with several members of the Chippewa and Ottawa tribe. All in all, the formal lessons that in my early years for Michigan history, all had an emphasis on the industries, the mining, the lumbering, the shipping, the auto, and the details of the interactions between the British and the French and the Anishinaabe were very vague. It was very glossed over. And I can't imagine that unless a teacher in the Michigan public schools goes to a resource like yourself or reads your book, would have the ability to accurately explain the events that took place. And so let's begin with timeline of events that occurred after the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
Sounds good, Gretchen. Thank you. Happy to be here. I'm going to start talking about the Declaration of Independence because it has a phrase in it that we Native people sort of make fun of it and at the same time have sort of glommed onto, which is the phrase merciless Indian savages. That if you read the Declaration from top to bottom, much of it is a complaint by the American colonists about British rules, British laws, and lots of other things. But one of the really big complaints was the fact that the King of England had prohibited colonists from really engaging with indigenous people at all, as much as and limit that as much as possible. And that is a product of a war fought in 1763 in the Western Great Lakes between a group of Anishinaabe Indian tribes and others, led by an Odawa Ogama leader out of the Detroit, Cleveland area. His name was Pontiac. They named cars after him now. But Pontiac was a visionary leader of Anishinaabe people who organized an attack on more than about two dozen British/colonial forts throughout the Great Lakes all around the same time. Again, this is before telephones or the telegraph, even the Pony Express. It was very difficult to organize such a coordinated attack. And other than the fort at Detroit itself, every single fort and run by the British government at that time fell to Indian people, at least for a period of time. And that was terrifying. And the British government realized quickly that the conflicts between British colonial and American colonials, and probably French and Spanish colonials as well, with Indians was leading to a lot of conflict. And so they hoped to relieve that conflict, to take control of the area a little bit more by prohibiting Americans, basically, from engaging with Indian people west of the Appalachian Mountains. And that was the reason that the Americans in 1760 or 1776, when they wrote the Declaration of Independence, were angry about British Indian policy. And so, as a consequence of the 1763 British Proclamation, which followed the 1763 war, we get the Declaration of Independence. And so that led to, of course, the American Revolution. The state of Michigan didn't exist back then, obviously, and really was a far-flung area away from sort of the focus of the revolution, to be sure. So for the first few decades of the United States, through basically the War of 1812, there really was no American presence in what is now known as the state of Michigan. This was Anishinaabe territory, and to the extent that there were colonials here, they were primarily British Canadian. Possibly some French leftovers from earlier centuries. So we're talking about the three fires, as you mentioned before, the Odawa, Potawatomi, and Ojibwe tribal nations. Primarily, the upper, what is now the Upper Peninsula of the state of Michigan is Ojibwe territory for the most part. And Lower Peninsula is a little bit more complicated. Detroit was sort of a regional trading hub. And so you had the Three Fires tribes, but you also had Wyandots or Hurons, Kickapoo tribes, Sac, Fox, some Shawnee, some other tribes too, probably some Haudenosaunee or Iroquois tribes would come through. So it was a bit of a mixing pot. Northern Lower Michigan on the western side, where Grand Traverse and Little Traverse Bay is primarily Odawa territory. As you go to the further south in West Michigan, as you get towards Grand Rapids and the Grand River Valley, you get more of a mix of Odawa and Potawatomi or Potawatomi Native peoples. And on the sort of the northeastern quadrant of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan is primarily Ojibwe, although a bit more of a mix. And that's really how things were until after the War of 1812, which ironically, the United States lost badly, but they still were able to negotiate a treaty that in which the British agreed to vacate much of the lands west of, the original 13 colonies, and that's how the Michigan, when is now the state of Michigan, came under the colonial claim of the United States government. Although it really wasn't until the 1820s or 1830s that there was much of a American governmental or military presence in what is now the state of Michigan. It was still primarily Anishinaabe territory. The first Indian War fought by George Washington as President of the United States, we typically call it Little Turtles War. It went from 1785 to 1795 and occurred in the Ohio River Valley. Michigan Indian people participated in this war quite considerably. And really, it was a war in which the United States realized that it was in no position to fight an Indian war, or really a war with anybody. But nonetheless, the 1795 treaty sort of carved up what we now know is that what became the Northwest Territory, and many Native people, suffered pretty greatly from the outcomes of that war. And one of the sort of the darker stories of that war, which is really important for our purposes, is that in 1794 or so, after 8 or 9 years of losing a war to a group of large groups of Indian people, the United States decided to adopt a policy militarily of kidnapping women and children and holding them hostage in order to force peace negotiations. It was a very successful tactic and one that the United States would use really in mostly in times of peace, but they would really use that tactic throughout the history of the United States well into the 20th century, till the late 20th century, really. And I'll get to that in a little bit later. You should know that in the 19th century, Michigan Anishinaabe tribes or Indian people would live a seasonal life. The summertime is like it is now. You go to the beach, you hang out, you get your water, you can grow, grow your gardens. We had sustainable agricultural practices rooted in the so-called Three Sisters, corn, beans, and squash. We did a lot of hunting and fishing around that time, preparation for the winter. It was a really good period of time. And then in the fall, when it starts getting cold, Michigan Indians would sort of break off into smaller kinship groups and retreat inland into the woods so that we could spend our winters huddling together effectively. And once the spring occurred, starting in February, that would be the beginning of sugarbush season, where Native peoples go to a third location. Native families, Native tribal communities would go to a third location, third locations to focus on sugarbushing for a time. And then it was the third as it returned back to the beaches and to agricultural and hunting fishing practices summertime, basically. And you should know that there are accounts well into the 1840s and 1850s of an Anishinaabe village that stretched effectively from, say, Sheboygan, now past the Straits of Mackinac, all the way down into the little Traverse Bay area, which is Wauganakising territory, and then stretching even further down into the Grand Traverse Bay and all the way as far south along the beaches as possibly Ludington, and one giant beach metropolis of Indian people. And at that time, Indian people, especially the Odawa tribal nations, had ownership or control of the waterways and the trade routes. So there's a reason why Canada's capital, which is way over in French Quebecois, is called Ottawa. And that's about as far as the Ottawa trade routes went, if not even further. And so that's gives you a sense of the range and the, you know, geopolitical power that Michigan, Ottawa's from Little Traverse and Grand Traverse and Little River possessed back in those days. So yeah, that gives you a sense of, you know, sort of Indian ways of moving around a little bit. And that was also one of the, you'll see one of the greater weaknesses that Indian people unfortunately possessed. So coming back to American history, in 1830, we have Andrew Jackson as president of the United States, elected in 1828. He's famously known as the Indian Killer. He invaded Spanish Florida three times to fight the Seminole tribal nations seeking escaped slaves. You might have heard about that in school books as well. Most people don't know there were three Seminole Wars, and most people don't know that Andrew Jackson basically lost all three of his armies every time he invaded France, or excuse me, French, I keep saying that, Florida. And that's the kind of story that wasn't even told really when he was doing that in the 18 teens and 1820s. He was successful at basically committing acts of genocide on Seminole and Miccosukee tribal citizens in what is now Florida, but he also destroyed most of his army. It was an incredibly expensive, bloody, bloody, bloody series of wars. Nonetheless, because he, for whatever reason, was declared the Indian Killer, he was elected in 1828. In 1830, he persuaded Congress to pass something called the Indian Removal Act, and he put people from the state of Michigan in charge of it, most notably Lewis Cass, who, you know, you probably see Cass Street, Cass County, all over the place here in Michigan and elsewhere in the Great Lakes. Well, he was Jackson's Secretary of War, and he was pretty bloodthirsty, too. And he really wanted the state of Michigan to be, well, what would become the state of Michigan, to be scrubbed completely of indigenous peoples. So the southern part of Michigan during the early part of the 1830s was a target of Lewis Cass and the Michigan Indian agent Henry Schoolcraft at that time to try to force them into signing treaties in which they would agree to leave, to remove. These, of course, led to trails of tears, trails of death. There's infamously, the Potawatomi Trail of Death that occurred in the 1830s, where hundreds of Potawatomi people from southwest Michigan and northern Indiana were forcibly marched all the way to Kansas. And that's why we have the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation in Kansas and also the Citizen Band Potawatomi Nation in Oklahoma. And remnants of that group even made their way back up into what is now Michigan and reformed as the Hanaville Indian Community in the Upper Peninsula and the Forest County Potawatomi in northern Wisconsin. But the 1830s also led Henry Schoolcraft and Lewis Cass to persuade a group of about three dozen Michigan Odawa Native people leaders to travel to Washington, D.C. to negotiate a treaty in 1836. And that treaty is still a critically important treaty to the tribes here. There are currently five federally recognized tribes that are signatories to that treaty: Grand Traverse Band, Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, Little River Band of Ottawa Indians, Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians in the UP, and Bay Mills Indian Community also in the UP. There's about probably three other bands that signed the treaty or versions of it that probably should be federally acknowledged now in one form or another, including the Grand River Band of Ottawa Indians, which is in the Grand Rapids area, the Burt Lake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, which was around the Burt Lake area, was also known as the Sheboygan Band, And I know a little bit less about this, but the Mackinac bands of Ojibwe Indians in the Upper Peninsula, closely affiliated with Sault Ste. Marie, are also potentially a separate tribe. And there may be others as well, but those are the eight that I'm firmly aware of. The 1836 treaty was designed was intended probably by the federal government to be a removal treaty, meaning placate the Indians for 5 years and then force them to leave to the West, really bribe them with offers of land and cash and that sort of thing. Keep in mind that Michigan in 1836 was very much the geographically was a very difficult place to actually do anything remotely approaching settlement or colonization. It was all trees, it was all swamps. There's no roads or highways other than the roads that the Anishinaabeg had actually carved throughout the wilderness. Once you get north, and you can see this if you're flying in a plane right now, of say Clair, Michigan, you're going to see that that's where the sort of the growing season stops being valuable. So you have the Grand River Valley, incredibly, incredibly valuable agricultural land. A little bit further north of that, it's mostly trees and scrub brush. There isn't a lot of mass agriculture down there, north of that area. And that made it incredibly difficult to force Indian people to leave. They could hide in the trees, they could hide in the swamps. We moved regionally. We moved really well. We had waterways. We had the canoes or jimaman that were incredibly technologically proficient. And there's no way they could march the Michigan Ottawas out of the state of Michigan after the 1836 treaty. But that was certainly the federal government's intent. But nonetheless, the treaty also said that if, for whatever reason, until the moment that the United States decided that it could, force people to leave, that even in the lands that the tribes had sold to the United States government, the Indian people here could hunt and fish on those lands and in the Great Lakes until they were, quote, required for settlement. And I'm going to tell you right now, very little of the land that is subject to the 1836 treaty was ever really required for settlement. There are certainly towns, obviously, and there's some mining and things like that, but most of it is just still trees and a lot of open space, lots and lots of state and national parks, national public lands. And if you look at a map, you'll see that very little of the sort of the northern lower part of Michigan, lower peninsula of Michigan, that was a part of the treaty, as well as sort of the half of the eastern part of the Upper Peninsula that was also a part of the treaty, were never really, quote, settled. They were, however, deforested, but that comes later. Around the time after the 1836 treaty, which was supposed to create reservations, Grand Traverse Band was promised a 20,000-acre reservation, which was primarily Old Mission Peninsula. The United States just never completed or perfected that treaty. Those lands were never really set aside, and for some of the tribes, they were never even surveyed. So that never really happened. And so in the 1840s, Indian people were in a weird position. They were here in Michigan. They had control of all of the economic activity, the waterways, everything that was going on, hunting and fishing. They by far outnumbered in terms of population any of the non-Indian groups in the area and in the entire state. But they had, under American law anyway, little or no rights to land. We were Anishinaabe people could not be citizens of the United States. They could not be citizens of the state of Michigan. And as a consequence of a lack of citizenship, land ownership was almost impossible. Even so, in the 1840s was sort of a really big, good period of time for Michigan Anishinaabe people, especially the Ottawas. I mean, we were exporting corn to the towns like around the Straits of Mackinac, the town that grew up around the Boardman River, obviously Traverse City and elsewhere, and not to mention maple sugar, which was one of the probably the most valuable agricultural product that was being generated at that time. And that was all in the control of Michigan Indians. Nonetheless, things started to fall apart as more and more settlers came in. And by the 1850s, I should mention the 1850 Michigan Constitution, which is one of the first ones ever here in the state of Michigan. There have been a lot of Michigan constitutions. The 1850 Constitution said that an Indian who became, quote, civilized could vote. So even before the American Civil War, it was theoretically possible for Indian people to acquire state citizenship and vote in state elections, not federal citizenship. They used to be separate, but they separated, but they are, but it was possible to have state citizenship. And, but the most Indian people refused to become a citizen of the state and vote because they were being forced to give up their treaty rights and their tribal relationships and their lands. And nobody really wanted to do that. So very few people, Native people, became citizens and voted after the 1850 Constitution. The next big treaty, and the last one really of any import for the Michigan-Ottawas, is from 1855. And that treaty set aside something like five or six townships in what is now Leelanau County and one township in Antrim County, where Keewaydin and Elk Rapids is. And it was supposed to include basically everything north of, say, you know, the three tiers of townships in Leelanau County. But there were plenty of wealthy non-native people already living in the Northport area, so the United States Senate excised Northport from that treaty. Nonetheless, it was still a robust amount of land set aside for the Grand Traverse Band citizens, and there was supposed to be a different kind of land ownership pattern instead of the establishment of a reservation owned by the tribe and its members collectively as one owner. The 1855 treaty introduced something called allotment into Indian land ownership. And the idea was that out of the township set aside, Indian heads of household could select about 80 acres of land or something like that, and at which point they would have a federal ownership, I guess you could say, of that allotment for 25 years. It would be owned in trust by the United States government for the benefit of that Indian head of household and their family. And at the expiration of the 25 years, that land would come out of trust and become fully taxable. And the Indian people who received a land patent from the federal government at that time would become American citizens and would have to pay taxes to the state and local governments for property issues and that property taxes and that sort of thing. But much like the 1836 treaty, that never happened. The allotment process often began, and many Native people did select parcels of land, but within the vast majority of them, within a year, would have lost that land. And the weakness that Indian people had, unfortunately, is their greatest strength, of course, which is our seasonal rotation of the way we live our lives. So you can imagine that if a Native person selected 80 acres in Leelanau County in July, and then at the end of the year, maybe around what we would call Thanksgiving now, they would start retreating into the interior to hang out in our winter lodges. Somebody would come and take over the cabin, go down to the federal land office in Traverse City and say, these Indians have abandoned this allotment. It's mine now under, say, the Homestead Act of 1862 or something like that. And that would be the end of it. Indian people would lose their land because they went hunting in the fall. They went to deer camp. Or if it was a different period of time, it was because they went to the beach to start their agricultural and fish and wildlife production, or sugar bush in the spring. Anytime Indian people left the allotment, it would be sure that when they got back, there would be other people there who would claim the allotment for them. And so nobody ever actually got through the trust period. Very few people were able to maintain their allotments through the 25-year trust period. And even at the end of the 25-year trust period, if you somehow still had control of your allotment, you'd have to start paying taxes. And that would have been around the 1880s, 1890s. And I'm going to tell you right now, the tax rate for Indian people was 4, 5, 10 times higher than it was for non-Native people. In Emmett County, where Little Traverse is right now, Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians is, they have a lot of, that was patterned in practice to wildly overcharge Native people on their property taxes, and then when they couldn't pay it, to issue a tax foreclosure, and that would be the end of that. So it was a particularly rough period of time. There were some, it was around the time also, after the Civil War, when we started having Indian mandatory boarding schools at places like Mount Pleasant, Holy Child in Harbor Springs, Michigan. There was one in the Upper Peninsula as well. Some Native kids were sent to Carlisle in Pennsylvania or Haskell Indian School in Kansas, all around the country. And that keep in mind that the going back to the 1836 treaty, Michigan Indian treaty negotiators actually asked the United States government to help them educate their kids. And so there are treaty provisions guaranteeing education to Native children going back as far as the 1836 treaty, maybe further. But and that was typically done for much of the 19th century after the 1836 treaty in day schools, where kids would go to school like kids go to school now, and then after the end of the day, they would go home. And the missionaries were unsatisfied with the amount of acculturation that they were seeing with Native kids. I mean, they were still speaking their language, and they were still following their own old cultures and traditions that deviated from things that you would learn in Protestant and Catholic primers. And so they were upset about that. After the Civil War, when Ulysses S. Grant, who was, of course, the general that I guess won the Civil War, became president, a lot of the Indian civil service jobs were filled by his former officers. So he was military, so a lot of his political patrons were also military. And he put them in charge of the boarding schools in Michigan here, or if it wasn't the military guys, it would be the missionaries, the Catholic and Protestant missionaries. And after the 1870s or so, boarding schools throughout the United States became really, really difficult to justify. All paid for by the federal government, much of them run by churches, pretty flagrant violation of the separation of church and state. The boarding schools run by President Grant's military, ex-military buddies became boot camps, and these were incredibly difficult places for most Native people to go to. Kids are kidnapped, taken to boarding school, often abused horribly there. Healthcare was at absolutely disgusting. There are hundreds, literally hundreds of bodies buried in and around the Mount Pleasant Indian boarding school, which is not that grounds are now owned by the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe, and they're closed off. There are also bodies buried that are still there around Holy Childhood Church, which is still a thing. Just about 10 years ago, they were digging up the street out in front of the Holy Childhood Church to repave it, and they started finding little bones of little children in the street and in the yard around Holy Childhood School. And so that stuff is all still there. And all of this is a real thing that happened. It was a really terrible period of time. The whole just step back, give you a little bit big picture of the latter half of the 19th, early part of the 20th century in the state of Michigan, was that starting in about the 1860s and 1870s, it became viable for timber companies to come in and start taking timber out. And so over the last few decades of the 19th century, in the first decade of the 20th century, the entire state of Michigan was deforested. Most of the initial funding or impetus for this deforestation was involved grants by the federal government to large railroad companies. Railroads would typically be given for free in exchange for the promise of creating a railroad, say from Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids all the way up to Traverse City and Petoskey, and all the way up to the Straits of Mackinac, was to give them timber. And so these grants of lands that were once owned and controlled and partially still occupied by Michigan Anishinaabe people were given to railroad companies. They deforested, wide swaths of land, about 10, maybe 20 miles wide, going north or across the state. You can still see sort of the growth patterns, even if you're in the air, especially between Grand Rapids and Cadillac and Traverse City, where the trees were deforested first by railroad companies, and then years later by timber companies proper. All of Michigan, other than two small stands of white pine trees, one in the UP, one in lower Michigan, were completely wiped out. They were vast forest fires that were started in latter years of the 19th century that went on for weeks, that covered through much of the lower peninsula during that period of time. Based on you cut all the trees down, you have nothing but scrub brush left, a lot of dead material lying around, and it was I could imagine it would have been a sight to see, quite devastating. The destruction of the forestry was that really led to the destruction of the livelihoods of Michigan Anishinaabe people. By the 1890s, 1880s, 1890s, and 1900s, you'll see that Michigan Indians couldn't retreat inland to hunt for fish and hunt for game in the woods because there were no woods anymore. And so they were forced to rely on wage labor, often with in mining camps or orchards, or often you will see pictures of Indian people actually working for lumber camps, cutting down trees and hauling them down to the town of the river. Now, horribly, bitterly ironic. Colonialism, to say the least, is quite ironic and evil at the same time. So let's see. Indians in Michigan, the tribes that I've mentioned, were treaty tribes. So that means they were acknowledged by the United States government as tribal nations that were sovereign. They were governmental entities, almost akin to foreign nations. And they possessed all the powers that a foreign nation had. They possessed the ability to enter into treaties with the United States government, for example. The US does not enter into treaties with Microsoft or even a state, the state of Michigan, and only enters into treaties with foreign nations and tribal nations. But that said, by the 1870s, the United States government was no longer entering into treaties with anybody, any Indian tribe. And the Secretary of the Interior in the 1860s and 1870s began a process that we would later call administrative termination of the tribal nations of Michigan. Now, what administrative termination basically means is the Secretary of the Interior would write a letter saying, "We don't recognize the Indians at Grand Traverse Band or Little River or Little Traverse or Grand River or Burt Lake, or it really, it, yeah, anywhere in the Lower Peninsula as ongoing legitimate entities that were sovereign tribal nations." It was just a pure stroke of the pen from the Secretary of the Interior and his underlings, and it was completely illegal. Only Congress can terminate the relationship between a tribal nation and the United States government. But despite being illegal, it was the way things were for about more than a century, really. If you start with the 1860s, all of the tribes, Grand Traverse Band, Little Traverse, Little River, Sault Ste. Marie, Burt Lake, Grand River, Mackinac Bands, all administratively terminated. Even the Potawatomi tribes in southwest Michigan that remain, like Pokagon and Gun Lake, were also administratively terminated. So there's only one tribe in the Lower Peninsula of Michigan when I was a kid growing up. But 1980 was a sea change because that's when Grand Traverse Band became federally recognized. And that all came about because starting in the late 60s, early 70s, Michigan Indians started treaty fishing again. And I kind of think they've always been treaty fishing, but the state of Michigan in the 1960s really began to enforce its conservation rules on hunting and fishing against Michigan Indians and with great discriminatory practice. And the state of Michigan, I think I've heard this. I can't confirm it. I'm looking around for this, but I believe that the state of Michigan is one of the first states, if not the first state, to create a conservation agency. And for the longest time, when I was a kid, it was called the Department of Natural Resources, and I believe it's called EAGLE now, or that's the acronym. And that was formed as a conservation entity in 1921. But in the 1960s, it was reorganized and weaponized against Michigan Indian people. And there was a Michigan State Supreme Court case called People versus Chosa that declared unilaterally that the treaties create guaranteeing fishing rights were just no longer valid, that there weren't any Indians around anymore, and the state of Michigan had control over all the hunting and fishing that was going on in the state of Michigan and the Great Lakes. And so they set some limits that made it really difficult for Native people to hunt and fish in their traditional territories. And so by the 1960s, it kind of came to a head. And Michigan Indian people started pretty regularly going out and fishing in flagrant violation of state law, asserting that they had a federal treaty right to hunt and fish as they pleased, and the state could do nothing about it. And it led to a lot of conflict, violence between Indian and non-Indian hunters and fishers, violence between state police and conservation officers attacking Indian people in particular who went out hunting and fishing. It was a really bad period of time. But it also led to an enormous amount of litigation led by Michigan Indian Tribes, Native American Rights Fund, that culminated in a 1979 decision in a case called the United States versus Michigan. Typically, we call that the Fox decision, named after the judge who wrote it. Sometimes it's called the gill-netting decision. But what the 1979 decision held was that Indian people retained treaty rights. I mentioned before that Indians in the treaty itself says that Indians stipulate to the right to hunt and fish until the lands are required for settlement. The treaty doesn't say anything about waters. It doesn't say anything about the Great Lakes. There's nothing in the treaty that limits the ability of Indian people to hunt and fish in the Great Lakes. And so they went out hunting, they went out and fished the Great Lakes. And the 79 decision confirms that the state didn't have the power to prevent that. And that eventually led to, organization. The tribes started coming back together after a long period of time of not really having any organizational capacity, and recognition of the federal government means a great deal. And so Grand Traverse Band became the first tribe federally acknowledged here in Michigan, outside of the tribes that, Saginaw Chippewa was the only Lower Peninsula tribe. Little Traverse and Little River followed in 1994. Burt Lake, Grand River, Mackinac bands are still waiting, but tribes are timeless entities, so we'll see how that goes. But federal acknowledgement meant that Indian tribes like Grand Traverse Band were eligible to receive federal money directly through a law we call Public Law 638. It's a self-determination statute. And so when Congress appropriates money to spend on a given Indian reservation or Indian tribe or tribal community, that's sort of a line item in the Indian Affairs budget. And that money can go directly now from Congress passing through the federal agencies like the Bureau of Indian Affairs directly to the tribes. And the tribes can provide services to themselves, to their own citizens. And it's, that's really what the modern era of federal Indian law is like. It's mostly tribes acting as really federal government contractors providing governmental services to ourselves. And those of you who've been around since the 80s and 90s will know that tribes like Grand Traverse Band started casinos. They've been able to generate additional revenue on top of the fairly paltry amount that Congress sends our way. So it certainly doesn't make anybody rich, but Grand Traverse Band is one of the biggest employers in the region. And you can say the same about Little Traverse in Emmett County, Sault Ste. Marie and Bay Mills up in Chippewa County, Little River down in Manistee County, and the Potawatomi tribes are massive economic engines now. And that's a consequence of self-determination, Indian gaming, and some other things. And there's a lot more to be said, but I think it's fair to say that, with tribal nations starting at sort of the barrel of a gun, it's turned around quite dramatically, even since I was a little kid. So it's a different kind of history, and it's certainly nothing that I ever learned when I was in high school or elementary school in the 70s and 80s. So I didn't even really learn any of this in college. I didn't learn any of it until I started working for Grand Traverse Band, litigating, the Turtle Creek case, and we had to actually figure out what our history was like. And it's just sad that we don't know these things.
But thanks to you, we do. There is a large rock monument with a plaque outside of the St. Kateri Catholic Church in Peshawby Town. And the plaque is embedded into the rock. And it says Peshawby Town, settled by Ottawa Chippewa Tribe, 1845 to 1945. Do you know anything about this plaque?
Well, the Peshawby family was really, really important in Leelanau County for quite a while. My understanding is they originated up in Emmett County. And there were a lot of Michigan Indians who were sending their kids, this is again pre-Civil War, sending their kids to missionary school to learn English, learn math and science stuff, Western math and Western science. But the original mission up there was an Austrian mission. So the kids were learning German. And this idea that they needed to find a English-speaking or British something mission so their school so their kids could learn English. And so the Peshawby and some others moved from Emmett County, what is now Emmett County, to Leelanau. And they hooked up with a guy named Doherty, who was an American missionary. So the 1945, it probably had like 1845 sounds about right when that would have happened. 1945 is around a period of time when the descendants of the Peshawby family, most notably Ben Peshawby, were trying to organize and persuade the federal government to acknowledge a tribe again. Remember, we were administratively terminated. So nobody ever really understood here what that meant, other than we got none of the benefits of working with the federal government at that time and all of the detriments. They came and took our kids, but they wouldn't provide governmental services to us. They forced us in the 1950s, forced many of us to move from the reservation and move into urban Indian ghettos in Chicago and Milwaukee and Grand Rapids and Detroit, kind of like emptying out the reservation in a lot of ways, but again, would not provide services to us. So 1934 was a year that is critically important nationally for Indian affairs. That's when Congress passed the so-called Indian New Deal, also known as the Indian Reorganization Act. And that was supposed to allow tribes to reorganize so that they could take control over their governmental services. And we were supposed to have a vote. Every tribe would be allowed to vote on whether or not they wanted to do this. But because of administrative termination in the 30s, the federal government refused to let the Michigan, Ottawas, and Potawatomis reorganize. There's no explanation for why, but that led to a lot of activism in the 30s, mostly primarily Ben Beshabi and others around that time. And probably that 1945 plaque was a recognition of that advocacy. And let's be frank, the reality that a lot of Native people went to fight in America's wars, often from throughout much of American history, not being even citizens of the United States. So that citizenship issue changed and ended in 1924. All Indians are citizens of the U.S. as of 1924. But even in the 40s and 50s, there was, federal colonization practices were still pretty vicious towards Michigan Indian people.
There are several veteran graves behind that St. Kateri Church, Ottawa and Chippewa tribal family names, I noticed as well. On July 22nd, in the ticker, the headline says, Grand Traverse Band lands $11.9 million National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration grant to support the Timber Shores acquisition, which is in the Northport area. And then it says the name for this land is Mashkigaki. Did I pronounce that correctly? Mashkigaki, Mashkigaki, which means marshlands, but it also means place of medicine. I'm just reading this from the ticker because this is where in times past tribal members would find food. Is this a lot? I see land back on t-shirts, bumper stickers. Is this what this means?
That's a big part of it. Yeah, in the 1970s, when the Peshawe Town Indians or Leelanau Indians started to organize and would become the Grand Traverse Band, there was about 12 and a half acres of land left. It was actually owned by a small church in Leelanau, near Lake Leelanau, I believe. That's all. That was our land base. Remember, we were supposed to have 20,000 acres set aside for a reservation, and that dwindled down to 12 and a half acres by the 1970s. So the tribe now probably owns something around 2,000 acres. Maybe about half of that is federal trust lands, meaning sort of core reservation lands. So our land base is tiny, and it's spread out over five counties, really, and Beaver Island. So yeah, every land purchase is kind of a land back situation. I know the tribe would like to thoughtfully purchase land with an eye towards strategy, and also, frankly, for the least amount of disruption to the non-Indian, non-tribal government and community members here in the region, because that's not good for anybody. So yeah, that's absolutely what that's about. And it's a big step. I mean, when I was a practicing lawyer in the 90s and 2000s, it was rare, if almost impossible, for the federal government to ever consider transferring lands to tribes themselves, or even allow or to enable tribes to purchase very much land back on or near their historic reservations. And so 20 years later, I mean, it's a big, big shift. It is about land back. So, you know, kudos to the tribe and to the current federal administration.
Yeah. There are so many place names that still remain, but like on old maps, some place names are on actual, signage, Anishinaabe place names. When you drive in like Northern Ontario, you see, or parts of Quebec, you see place name signage in English, French, and Anishinaabe. And I wonder what you think about that happening here in Michigan.
I think it's happening already. I mean, the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Reservation, in and near Mount Pleasant, for the longest time when I was a kid, there were no signs that it was there. Now there are, and they're in the language, and you can even see them on the highway. So it's a symbolic thing, but it's an important thing, and it's starting to happen. I think what you're seeing nationally is some of the older names of even mountains, like Mount McKinley. We don't call it Mount McKinley anymore. Sorry, Ohio. It's Denali, right? I mean, so you're starting to see the traditional names of indigenous peoples come back for place names, and that's really important. There were a lot of really racist names too that are starting to go away as well. And it's telling that here we are in 2024, and the current Secretary of the Interior is a tribal citizen. Her name is Deb Haaland, out of New Mexico. She's, as Secretary of the Interior, she is basically in control of the federal public lands outside of military reservations. And one of the first things they did was just try to figure out how many place names on federal lands around the country use the word squaw, which is an epithet of indigenous women. And it was hundreds of places. So they're methodically changing all of those. And that's happening a little bit here in Michigan, too. So I think that's a real easy thing. What's harder for people, to be frank, is to acknowledge that Indian people that they thought, like you said at the beginning, were sort of gone or completely suppressed are, become their bosses. You can go work for a tribal government, you can go work for tribal economic enterprises, and you might work alongside or work with or work for Native people. And that is hard for people to acknowledge in the first instance. But once the checks, those paychecks start rolling in, people are much happier about it.
I'm Gretchen Carr. Thank you for listening to The Traverse Cityist. This episode of The Traverse Cityist was sponsored by the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians Tribal Council. Thank you.